gifts of spirit, light, and insight, we welcome you with joy.
Thank you. All the years that I have taught Befriending the Shadow, I never have had, I don't know what word to put here, I'll leave it blank, that I haven't been visited by the shadow. And today is no exception. I'm finding myself feeling exceptionally vulnerable. And those of you who go to St. Anthony's know that sometimes when I give a petition, I can't quite get it out because I'm a thinking type. And thinking types, when they are moved with feeling, don't know how to hold it. And tears come and bursts of emotion come. And as I sat there, I thought, well, I have a little parable or from a book called The Spirituality of Imperfection. And it's a book that our Pax Christi group read for 2 years here in Santa Barbara. And we've just found it so, so helpful. As I was doing this preparation, I came across one particular one, and I didn't know how I'd use it, but I've decided to use it as the opening, if I can find it. Okay. A man walking through the forest saw a fox that had lost its legs, and he wondered how it lived. Then he saw a tiger come up with game in its mouth, and the tiger ate its fill and left the rest of the meat for the fox. The next day, God fed the fox by means of the same tiger. The man began to wonder at God's greatness and said to himself, I too shall rest in a corner with full trust in the Lord, and he will provide me with all that I need. He did this for many years, but nothing happened, and he was almost at death's door when he heard a voice say, O you who are in the path of error, open your eyes to the truth. Stop imitating the disabled fox and follow the example of the tiger. One of the things I'm aware of, and I also seem to note it in people who I work with in therapy, is that we're often very complicit in our victimization. And today, I'm going to be like the tiger. So, the opening statement...
Your name tag is hooked up on your glasses.
Thanks. Thank you. Okay, thanks. On my written material, the opening sheet thought is, blessed are the cracked, for they let the light through. Our book, Integral Christianity, is a hefty book. And I want to send kudos to Paul Smith for this incredible tour de force, but also to Bob During, who has been trying, I don't know how many years, to get this on the agenda for Word and Life. So thank you, Bob. But my beef with this book is that in a book of 374 pages, there are only 11 pages on the shadow. Then there's a second beef I have with it, that he outlines five S's for the overview of the whole book, and they are stages, states, standpoints, shadow, steps. They all begin with S, but only four end with S. there are many shadows, not just one. So I think that chapter, maybe in another edition, could be expanded and expanded and expanded, because indeed we have many shadows. We have not only positive and negative shadows for our own personal journey, but we have a shadow, positive and negative, for every group we are a member of, our families, our communities, our worshiping communities, maybe even Santa Barbara County or California, the nation, and worldwide. We have shadows, positive and negative, galore. So what have I decided to do today? Well, I'm going to just quickly outline what I'm going to do, not maybe so as quickly as I'd like, but then go ahead and do it. You know, I think they said in the Navy, they tell you what they're going to tell you, they tell it to you, and then they tell you what they told you. So what I'm going to do today, the main thing is I'm not going to deal with a personal shadow. What I'm going to do is, first of all, locate the concept of shadow in the context of dualism and non-dualism that we studied a couple of years ago in Roth's book, Beyond Now. And then I'm going to locate the shadow in terms of the stages that Paul Smith mentions, and actually stages that come from Cal Wilber's, you know, tour de force. They are person-centered or egocentric, nation or ethnocentric, and lastly, world-centric. I'm not going to linger on the personal shadow, even though, you know, I have a lot I could say with much less nerves on befriending the shadow. And why am I not going to do it? Well, for two major reasons. One is, I think Paul Smith does an excellent job. He makes use of a pattern that Wilber devised, the 3-2-1 pattern. You know, first of all, looking at them, because most of the time we recognize shadow by who we project stuff on, positive or negative. And then we have to go to thou, and then finally to owning it ourselves. The 3-2-1, them, thou, I. If you didn't read this chapter, please read it. It is so tender. It is so disarming. But then there's another reason I'm not going to talk in shadow in a personal sense. And that is that here at Word in Life, 8 months ago, Dave Rico talked on it in an absolutely splendid way. Dave Rico has a book on shadow entitled Shadow Dance. I think the subtitle is, you know, like taking back the power that we have lost in the shadow. And I listened to his presentation here in the way that Tom has made so available to us through the recordings. And it was vintage Dave Rico. So I don't think I could improve on it. So not only am I going to not linger on the personal shadow, likewise, I'm going to skip the nation or the ethnocentric shadow. Not because I don't think there's a lot of negative and positive energy going around in regard to our nation, but I really think it's too hot to handle. And also, I don't want us to lose our tax-exempt status. And so that leaves the world-centric. The world-centric in terms of its positive and negative shadow. And where are we in regard to the world. I'm going to mention it later, but Judith McDermott unwillingly or whatever got me into thinking about this. But another thing that teased me into doing this is a quotation on page 6 in Paul Smith's book. He says this: the world problem is not, I've added just, the world problem is not just global warming, terrorism, hunger, or disease. The world's problem is that we don't have enough people at the world-centric level to solve our world-centric problems. That's sort of a variation of Einstein's famous statement about we can't solve today's problems with today's theories. I would add to Einstein, who was mainly a person of the mind, that we can't do it with the same energy levels of survival and self-importance, you know, those lower chakra. We must use the upper chakra energy levels to even bear looking at the world problems. So I'm going to talk about the shadow of the world, our world, and this is a pretty daunting topic. But my goal is to empower us to be world carers, lovers, tenders, energetically, without plunging us into despair or shame or inertia that such a huge task evokes. And then I want to end with time for discussion. Discussion either on the comments that I've exposed here, but comments on, say, the whole course, because even this course potentially has a shadow, positive and negative. Say, let's do it. Tom, you got me out a flip chart, but I don't know if I can use it since my head got around this. Okay. So the first thing is to locate shadow in the context of dualism and non-dualism. So for those of us who took Beyond Now, that program with Richard Rohr a couple of years ago, we can sort of scratch our heads and try to remember some of it. And those of you who didn't, it's available through the courtesy of Tom's website for the clicking. Integral Church, in particular, is built on non-dualism as a developmental goal. But it recognizes that in Western world, that three of the important steps, warriors, the traditional, but especially the modern times, is very dualistic. Actually, dualism, as a philosophy, goes back at least to Plato and Aristotle. They were dualists. In dualism, it's not two-ness that is the problem, but that one of the pair is privileged and the other marginalized. One is dominant and the other is derivative. One is elevated, sanctified, beatified, and the other is demonized. In a non-dual framework, one member is not privileged. In fact, not even totally separated from the other. If we recall the yin-yang symbol, that wonderful symbol which I won't attempt to draw right now, it is a circle in which there's like two fish, circling each other. And deep, and one is black and one is white, a very basic pair. But deep in, the white is a black. Deep in, the black is a white. to indicate the inseparability of these two if we live in a non-dualistic environment. I'm going to do a little aside here. Two of the prevalent modes of thinking right now are New Age on the one hand and science. I see the danger in some of the discourse that comes out of this, in that in the New Age, I fear that they are dualistic, because in many cases, they neglect the shadow. In fact, they think it's a dirty word, and it should be excluded from one's befriending. In science, like Richard Dawkins, and we could go on with more names, but they won't come to me like this, and I didn't write them down. They're confirmed atheists. So what do they deny as having a place? The spirit. What we need is a scientist who can be open to the most incredible miracles that are everywhere to be seen, to those who will see, and the New Age person to have the courage to face perhaps their own shadow, but the shadow that gives depth and substance and meaning to the incarnation. The two biggies in dualism are spirit and matter. They are the ones that Plato and Aristotle fell prey to. Plato was a spiritualist. He didn't think this world, you know, was a real world, and that it, what we call matter, was nothing but shadow on the wall of the cave. Aristotle, by contrast, was a materialist. And even though they both in some way spoke of God, philosophies have supported in awkward ways during the time of rationalism, modernism, this bifurcation into being a dualistic world. East is east and west is west, and never the twain shall meet. Now, just to give a little nod to person and her shadow, I want us to just imagine for a minute, what about a person and her shadow? Are they so juxtaposed that deep in the death of even an egocentric person, there is a shadow? And vice versa, that deep in the shadow, there is the person with all of their gifts? That these two might be looked at as the yin-yang symbol. Or another image that is, I think, particularly helpful to some, and it's the Zen image. The yin-yang symbol comes out of China. The Zen image comes, you know, out of basically in India. And that is of the lotus with its roots in the mud. And that the lotus blossom cannot be separated from the mud in which it grows. And the mud cannot be looked at without looking at the lotus flower. In Wilbur's map and in Paul Smith's working of the map, we go on to other levels beyond, other steps, I think is a word he uses, beyond modernism to postmodernism. We had David Griffin here two or three weeks ago, who also talked to us about Whitehead's thought and Dave's own thought about postmodernism and how non-dualism looks philosophically. But the theory is that we have basically grown up in a dualistic world. If we were among the native peoples, we might not have grown up in a non-dualistic world, in a dualistic world. It is one of the important, I'll say, goodies that we can recover from the so-called third world, that they know more about non-dualism today than we do. So if we grow up in a dualistic world, then we denigrate half of all the qualities that we encounter. So that, say, if we're just looking at something like Jung's theory of psychological types, I learned early on that thinking could get me somewhere. But it meant I neglected the feeling function. And so I have to recover that from the mud. And it doesn't always come up smoothly and well developed. But it's important. And if it stays detached and separated from me, then I'm only, you know, half of the thinking-feeling dynamic. So the unowned, undeveloped quality of any peer takes on often a primitive and unattractive, maybe awkward quality, mainly because of lack of use. Today, especially, more often than not, the shadow is not so much the seven deadly sins as greed, pride, lust. We could go through all of them. Today, it's almost as though the thing to be elevated is greed, Ayn Rand, pride, lust, Las Vegas, okay? They are increasingly celebrated. So the journey in recovering the shadow might be different for different peoples. So now if we go to the question of locating shadow in the context of world-centric stage. Again, I want to read Paul Smith's statement. The world problem is not just global warming, terrorism, hunger, or disease. The world's problem is that we don't have enough people at the world-centric level to solve our world-centric people. And yet, as I started to reflect over that, I realized how incredibly blessed we are here in Santa Barbara. We could not say we don't have world-centric people here. And what I'm going to do is do a beginning of a shout-out list to what we have here. I'm going to start with the Immaculate Heart community and to their one of their missions, La Casa de Maria. For, I don't know, at least 40 years, part of their mission statement has been to do blah, 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 all the things, in order that we might participate more responsibly in the creation of a just and peaceful world. It's there. And when I went about 10 days ago to a celebration of their retiring the debt for their renovation, they had invocations by four different persons, Jewish, Christian, Islam, and Native American. So even in that detail of the program, the sense of having a celebration tended by all the four corners, so to speak, they are present. But I also think of the invitationals at La Casa when Don was there. At that time, La Casa hadn't yet attained the former Jesuit property, and they had a little extra cash. And they had these big picture conferences where they invited experts from all over the world to come. These were experts that could talk about such things as democracy or democracies. They could talk about water and the threat that it might not be available for us in the future. They talked about different forms of government, knowing from the inside what these were. Those were some very important years, and because I got to sometimes sit in on that, it formed my own conscience. Here in Santa Barbara, the greatest Santa Barbara, I think of Pacific Graduate Institute. Why? Their motto is, for the sake of tending the soul of the world. For the sake of tending the soul of the world. A very different type of motto for a degree-granting institute. But the soul of the world is very present. Though sometimes we would have to call certain areas to accountability when, more power was given to administration than to students or faculty. I taught at Pacifica for 11 years, and that was, again, a very blessed time for me. Where else does my mind go when I think of the world tending that happens already here? Well, one to a very dear friend of mine. I don't know if she's here today. Carol? Carrick? Yeah. In going to Uganda, when Carol and Michael were thinking about going, to serve some place on the earth, they wanted to make sure they didn't go in with the power of government. And so they sought and sought till they found a group that would go in at the grassroots and be there and help the people in that particular dualism. But another example, last year she invited me to join her in going to the Santa Barbara Film Festival. And I sort of thought we'd be going to see, some kind of trendy indie. But what she brought me to was even much more wonderful. It was a documentary on Aung San Suu Kyi. Yeah, you say that fast enough, you get by. The winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, and a woman whose life is just amazing. I don't know if it's available, but that documentary is something to see. So inspirational. She is, since we saw that film, she has been released from house arrest. I'm sure you've seen that in the news, and elected to office in Burma / Myanmar. I think also of Maureen Earls. I know she's registered for this, but I don't think she's here today. She's in Haiti. She has brought to Santa Barbara the project of Fonds Cosse, which is a microloan program in which Santa Barbara has adopted one area of Haiti. And I also want at the same time to mention people like the Beckers and others who have made several trips to Haiti. Anne, you've gone to Haiti too, haven't you? Yes. They showed us some pictures of it once at one of the Fonds Cosse. Yes, Irish night, that's right. Of course, Haiti and Ireland sort of go together. No. But we saw that it wasn't an easy trip getting to where our particular Santa Barbara place is. There's more, and I'm not going to stop yet, because there's more. I think we need to have a sense of the world tending that happens here. So Alice MacDonald, and her on a much more theoretical level, I couldn't make last Wednesday. It conflicted with my dance, star dances night. But the evolutionary consciousness of Teilhard, because we need theoretical material behind having hope. When the science, the materialistic scientists, talk of entropy, we need to know that entropy isn't the only game in town. Alice MacDonald. I hear that Ginny Cashman is not here today. I'm not sure if you all know that Ginny founded this group. She founded this group more than 30 years ago with her husband, who has since died. And they asked Virgil, Father Virgil, who has also since died, you know, to do a very sort of un-Catholic thing, hold Bible study groups. And this is what has evolved out of that. Ginny has given a lot of her energy to conscious evolution, Barbara Mox Hubbard's program. I want to also mention Judith McDermott, who in preparation for her trip to Thailand and Burma, I do envy you getting into Burma, is reading about the perils of colonization and decolonization. And it is this that led me into what I want to mainly talk about today. And that is the image inherent in the notion of colonization and decolonization. Years ago, I heard James Hillman in a lecture say, we must return autonomy to the colonies. We must return autonomy to the colonies. He was talking on more than one level, and as a psychologist, he certainly was talking about it on the personal level, but he was also talking about it on the global level. What I would like us to look at together is how we can search for the shadow in this image, the image of returning autonomy to the colonies. Now, at Pacifica, image is very important. In a large part of our philosophical heritage, the word is at the beginning. In the beginning was the word. Pacifica is a lot more Platonic. And in the beginning is the image. And so here is an image that I want us to have sort of a sense of. What does it mean to return autonomy to the colonies? Well, first of all, we need to have a little bit of idea of what colonization is in modern times, where modern times begins like 15th century. Okay, as early as the 15th century, Europeans were beginning to see the planet as a globe. Sure, there were flat earthers. They were most likely flatliners there too. You know what flatliners are. They are people who try to let their brain waves go down to zip because the high of coming back. Yeah? They were flat earthers. Okay, but flat earthers exist even to today. But there were those who had the vision of the planet as a globe. This image, the planet as a globe, spawned a new migration. We had had many migrations before that, the out of Africa migration that went on 40 to 60,000 years. But here we are now in Europe in the 15th century, 16th century. So this vision spawned a new migration of explorers, conquerors, missionaries, mercenaries. And we have in front of us the image of colonization. At the same time, I want you to think of this personally. Because when we come to consciousness as an infant, as 3 months old, 6 months old, 12 months old, we start colonization. And it is me, not me. And what's more important? Me. Okay. So the viewers of the globe saw all of this territory not being used. And they wanted it. They went out to conquer or to convert because they experienced the people in the colonies as not us, for the most part, not white, not dualistic, which was the way to think, you know, as other. And so this process moved on in which, for the most part, by the 16th century, 17th century surely, 18th, the world could almost be divided into the colonizers, European countries, and the colonized, the American continent, but the whole southern hemisphere. Okay, can you imagine that? Do you not? Can you just see little old Europe up there? In centuries before, China had also done some of this. But at this time, the time that we psychically live in, is the time of the colonization of all of those people of color. In the process, we in the United States got decolonized pretty early. And I imagine one reason we got decolonized pretty early is that a large part of the native population in the United States, in Canada, were decimated, more than decimated, by smallpox and things of that nature. I think that's my cell phone. Oh, dear. If it is, would you just take it, the offending object, out of the room? Gee, I didn't hear that message this morning turn off yet.
I think it gave up.
Oh, good. It could even be a call from Don. My husband, Don, left for a conference, and he got stuck at the airport in Santa Barbara for 4 hours, diverted to Denver, and can you believe it? He couldn't take off until about 11 p.m. because there was snow in Denver, and every plane had to be de-iced over and over again. So he left me a little memo on my iPad saying, arrived 1 a.m., which means that he wasn't going to be available for a phone call till later. Okay, around 1776, we in the United States decolonized. And it was a process that was pretty amazing. And we can go back and look at it. But as is often the way, we became ourselves colonizers. We don't call them colonies, we call them territories. But it's there. Now, this image of, you know, restore autonomy to the colonies is most likely not a very moving image for many of you, most likely most of you. But I got to talk, so I got to choose. And I grew up in a colony. I grew up in the West Indies, in a small island called St. Kitts. And when I was growing up, I was incredibly aware of the tension between the 97% black former Africans and the 3% Europeans. We always thought of the Brits as benign colonizers. And I think largely they were. But they were benign colonizers to me and my sisters. But not to the son of the maid. We never used the word maid in those days. To the servant next door. This child who was most likely my age as I was growing up, grew up to be the first president of St. Kitts Nation. And now the airport is called the Bradshaw International Airport. I can still hear my sisters say, but he was only son of a servant. You know? So there in that benign colony, these people were treated as have-nots. And great nervousness broke out when there was the move to for them to take back, to develop a kind of democracy in which one vote would have some weight. I also remember as a child, it was just very, very poignant to me. I remember when in St. Kitts we had one movie house, but we would get some really good movies at the Sugarcane Factory Rec Center. And we had the movie Tale of Two Cities. I don't know if you've seen The Tale of Two Cities. I'm talking about 1950. And it was typical when the movies came and we all viewed the movies that they would then make a journey through the countryside and be shown in the government schoolhouses, which were always one-room schoolhouses. But this movie did not make the circuit. And I remember asking why. And the answer was, we don't want to give those people some ideas. The process of decolonization is not an easy task. And I think it's often not well done. Perhaps one of the greatest damages of colonization ranges from the damages to the spirit of the people, to their self-worth. But it goes the whole way to such things as the infrastructure. An infrastructure that the colonizers are proud of, but they didn't notice that all the roads went to the sea, to the ports, where they could carry off the goods back to the colonizers. And that there were no roads from one African country to another or among themselves. Amazing. In each of these examples, if you are wanting to think of this on a personal level, you might also think how the colonizing you have done to your own psyche by choosing this value and not that value limits what you can do. Now, one of the reasons I think that decolonization has been so largely unsuccessful is that I think the response has been dualistic. And often, you know, what before, say, the European was on top and the conquered below, and then there's a reversal. And the reversal is not necessarily that the Europeans down below, because they didn't stay around. They, for the most part, left. Both of my sisters left and came to the United States, which, you know, was their freedom to do. But not. But there was like, who can we colonize? And so we have situations like Zimbabwe with, somebody help me with the name of the guy.
Mugabe.
Who, you know, is more tyrannical than any colonizer. but its dual is replicated. Now, in Africa, we have one absolutely amazing counterexample, and that is the process of truth and reconciliation. If you've never followed that, it is just amazing that you could have a justice process in which people would come forth and tell their truth, speak truth to power, and that you could live because of a dedication to love and justice and getting alongness of those people. Oh, this is a little cynical, but I think I'll say it. In our map, democracy is the answer, where we have shared decision-making, shared risk, shared resources. But when I think of this, I remember the dry remark of G.K. Chesterton regarding Christianity. Too bad it's never been tried. Could we say that about democracy? Okay. I said I wasn't going to get into nation-centered stuff. But where am I going still today? What kind of time do I have? Almost time for a break. Okay. I have this I can certainly do, but I have an exercise that I want to do, and I think that maybe within the discussion I could do the exercise and still be okay on time. So where am I going today? Well, I said at the outset I want to empower us to be world tenders energetically without plunging us into despair or shame or inertia. Years ago, when the world clock was 5 minutes or less to midnight for thermonuclear destruction, some of us in this very room, I think of Ann Jaguar here especially, we attended a very powerful retreat sponsored by Stillpoint. It featured Joanna Macy and Matthew Fox. Remember that, Ann? Ann was the force behind it, I think. It followed Joanna Macy's program, Despair and Empowerment in a Nuclear Age. And she had us come together and really tolerate some of our feelings of despair. She had us energetically rise to places of love and caring and tending, and through that to experience feeling empowered. So as I was working on this program, I thought, you know, well, that's what I want to do today. And I went through a number of different iterations of what I could do, and then I thought, I wonder if Joanna Macy, what is she doing right now? And I found her book just published this March on active hope. See if I can find here the whole title of her book. It says, I think it's What to Do, here it is. How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy. In Wilbur and Paul Smith's model, in a section that I haven't mentioned, we talk about the different levels of energy. And you know, the levels of energy must build one upon the other. We don't graduate from one and go to the other. We must, I think Paul Smith used an image of escalator to talk about in capturing the lower levels and going on. But so often we start at the bottom levels and stay there. The levels of survival, the level of power, the level of self-importance, of self-interest. And these are good levels, and some problems can be solved at these levels. But we need the other levels. What levels? The level of heart. The level of the throat, speaking truth to power. We need the level of wisdom. We need to cultivate the perception of one world. Not last week, but 3 or 4 weeks ago, I missed it, but I listened to it on Tom's tape. Pat McClure spoke of the heart. And after I heard her speak of the heart and heart energy, I Googled it. And my goodness, I couldn't believe what I found about that the emanations from the heart are so tangible that they outread the emanations from the brain. Google it yourself. It's incredible. I have a dear friend, and she's now in New Hampshire. Damn it. She could sit next to me, and she could tell where my heart was. She had tuned her receptors so sensitively that she read each other's hearts. Because, you see, not only do we have this enormous power in the heart, but we can use it to communicate. I'd like to see more about this, but I've been wondering to what extent is the quality of telepathy based on heart communication more than brain communication? Because of the nature of the information in it. Okay, so we want to stop. What I'd like in the second half is to have discussion, and then I'll end with an exercise from Joanna Macy and a co-writer, his last name, well, I forgot it. We'll end that way. Okay, let's go.